Hello, beloved listeners, and welcome to another hour of Advanced Living Radio. This is Kenneth Lesser, and I am thrilled and delighted to be your host again today. And you know, here at Advanced Living Radio, we have a guiding prayer, a thought, an intention to help bring value to you every day, and that's guided by this prayer. Heavenly Father, show me the best ways to have the most fun, inspiring the largest number of people to easily, naturally, joyously experience vibrantly, exquisitely healthy, wealthy, passionate living in the shortest amount of time with the least intrusion into their lives, so we can all get our needs met and celebrate a global loving community that works for everyone. So that's what we're going for. And just like they say, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? Well, one week at a time. Keep bringing you value so that you can make the choices and take the steps that are going to bring your life into a more beautiful place. And here we are launching into 2012, and oh my gosh, are we in for a big treat. And before we get into that, I want to take just a moment to invite you to help support our sponsor. There's a website, advancedlivingcomfort.com. And when you go to that website, you'll see a plug-in device. We call it the Clark Kent Clock with Superpowers. When you plug that in, it's like having the Dalai Lama show up and meditate in your room, harmonizes the electromagnetic energy, raises the healing field. Intuitive psychics, people like Jack Canfield, Michael Beckwith, a lot of good folks love and use this to their advantage. So check out advancedlivingcomfort.com. And now, here we are, 2012, and this has like been touted for all these years. It's sort of like, well, geez, this was like year 2000 and Y2K, another end of everything, big changes, and so what are we going to do? Well, how about if we had a wonderful guest today that has just been in the metaphysical movement for many years and is absolutely fabulous in what he's got to share with us. And so we're going to have the lowdown on 2012 and a bunch of other amazing things. Get ready, folks. We're going to have as our guest today the amazing Stuart Wild. And I think if he had a middle name, it should be Very, because it should be Stuart Very Wild, because he is just so amazing. He's the author of over 20 books on spirituality and personal development, and you can find all about him at his website, Stuart, S-T-U-A-R-T, Wild, W-I-L-D-E.com. And he is literally considered by many the greatest living metaphysician in the world today, with some of the most famous people in New Age, New Thought, writers, teachers, including folks like Deepak Chopra, that they have privately studied with him or have been greatly influenced by his work. And in the 1980s, Stuart correctly described the etheric life field around humans in precise detail. Previously, it was known only in vague terms in discussions about the human aura, and he wrote about the first of many precise and verifiable etheric exercises and sensations in his book, The Quickening. It came out in 1995. Oh boy, so get ready. And over the last 10 years, he has published hundreds of his visions, many of which have now come to pass. So welcome aboard, Stuart.
Ken, how are you today?
I am better now that you're on the phone, I'll tell you that.
I'm right here, sir.
Well, this is fabulous. And you doing well as well?
Yes, thank you very much. Yeah, I'm just traveling around at the moment, and yeah, it's great. I'm in Canada. I love the place, and
good.
Enjoying it a whole bunch.
Well, I'm glad that you're off and about doing a little vacationing, and I'm curious because we alluded to this thing of 2012, and I want to know, would you help guide us right away? Why is the world not ending in 2012?
Well, first of all, the Mayan calendar ends at in 2012, but the date was completely arbitrary. I mean, they picked a date to start it. So it's coincidental that 5,130-something years of the Mayan calendar happens to come to 2012. But there's no evidence. I mean, they never said the world was going to end. Their calendar ends, sure enough. Also, they say it does. And, of course, the Mayans were rubbed out in 700 to 800 AD. It's thought that they were rubbed out by a revolt of the slaves, because they had tens of thousands of slaves that they captured from indigenous tribes locally there in Central America mostly. And they were rubbed out in this revolution, and the priests and the aristocracy and the kings were all gotten rid of, and then the society crumbled. But, I don't know, they didn't seem to be able to predict their own end, so I got very dubious about them being able to predict ours.
Yeah.
No, I think the world will definitely be going on after 2012. There's no question of that.
Well, that's good. And so it lets us shift our focus of attention to what do I do now that this whole place is ending to what can I do in some other ways, which ties in with your work, I believe. And on Coast to Coast, George Norrie is referred to you as the greatest metaphysical visionary in the world today, and for folks out there that may not be familiar with that, would you help explain what is a metaphysical visionary?
Well, essentially, it's a person that, you know, can close their eyes and go into trance and move through these other dimensions and these other worlds. And I've had the ability to do that for, like, several decades. And when I see visions in there, which have been, like, in the tens of thousands, well, hundreds of thousands now, I write about them, and a lot of them are prophetic visions, and then other visions are visions that teach about the nature of these other dimensions and how they are and what they are. In the 1990s, I described dimensions as vectors, so directions. So they lay on a line of direction, and that is the dimension. And then by 2005, the string theory scientists proved mathematically that dimensions are directions, that they are vectors. So they proved it mathematically. Because when I saw it, I had not enough mathematics to be able to describe the mathematics of it. But by watching it, I could see it's a direction. And eventually it was proven mathematically that a dimension is essentially a direction. So from observing and watching and stuff, I wrote it all out. I wrote out the etheric field, which is essentially the life force around your body. And most of the teachings of that were from the Theosophists, and they called it the human aura. And they brought a lot of the Hindu knowledge with them. They kind of carried it to the West, and they did a fantastic job. Madame Blavatsky and Henry Alcott and so forth, Ernie Besant. And it was all very rudimentary, but it was amazing at the time. In the 1920s, when they bought the information, everybody was gobsmacked. But in these inner worlds, you can see the etheric field, you can see the feelings. It's way more than just the pretty colors of the aura. And the Theosophists have all the colors of the aura, like blue, purple, indigo, blue, yellow, orange, green and red, but not quite in that order, but anyway. So they talked about the colors of the aura, but a lot of the aura is feelings, and most of it is fractal geometries. And if readers are not familiar with fractals, then they just have to go on Google and type in the word animated fractals, and they'll see these extraordinary geometries that make up the Mandelbrot set and the Julia set and the various mathematical formula. And our world is a geometry. So your little finger, the nail on your little finger, is a spiral of colors, of geometries. And so I describe those inner worlds and the fractal worlds, and people read the stuff and they understand it, and then a lot of people I've taught them to see, because obviously you have to be able to see these worlds. Seeing is believing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a friend called Wayne Dyer, Dr. Wayne Dyer, who's a good friend of mine, and he's like been to my seminars and stuff like that, and he wrote a book called You'll See It When You Believe It. And, you know, that was really this idea that what you believe, you manifest. And it's the same with these inner worlds. Once you've seen them, you'll believe them. And then a lot of people, if they've never seen them, they've got to learn to see. And that's one of the things that I teach people, or have done in my courses and so forth.
All right. Now, if people want to learn this, how do they go about moving ahead in that direction?
Well, all seeing comes from feeling. So essentially, the people that can't see are dysfunctional, usually, in their feelings. And by feelings, I don't mean emotions, sort of whether they're romantic emotions or raving and being angry or reacting and counter-reacting. Feelings are like a sensitivity that comes from softness, from perception. So it's the ability to read the forces, the natural forces around us, the forces of nature. And I wrote a book about developing the sixth sense called that, How to Develop Your Sixth Sense. Actually, I think the book is actually called Sixth Sense. So that talks a lot about opening up to these feelings. And then I've done a lot of work in South America with the South American shamans. And we run a lot of ayahuasca ceremonies in Brazil. We used to be in Brazil, and then we moved eventually to Ecuador. And we do them there in Ecuador where it's completely legal. And ayahuasca is a supplement. It's not really a drug. It's a supplement, and it supplements the DMT in your brain, in your pineal.
Ah.
DMT is the visionary drug. And so a lot of people can't see because they're DMT depleted. And that comes from stress and diet and so forth. So we take people down to South America and we give them this Amazonian drink. And, I mean, it heals a lot of things. Like, it heals depression, literally, in one drink.
Mm.
And it's very helpful with Parkinson's disease and various other diseases of the intestines, because ayahuasca kills parasites, and so it gets rid of all those sort of various worms and so on that people have in their bellies. And so that's how I've taught people to see, is by taking thousands upon thousands of people down to Ecuador, to a five-star resort that used to be the presidential palace, and giving them this very strange brew from the Amazon. And that's the quick way. That's the short and fast and quick way of learning to see.
Hmm, I like that. And that was, you said D as in dog, M as in mighty, T as in Tom, DMT?
DMT, yeah. And
okay.
So it's the DMT in your pineal that allows you to see. It's what creates the dreams and the visions.
Mm.
And so it's dimethyltryptamine. And you can look it up on Wikipedia, just put DMT in it.
Okay.
And so what's his name? Stossner, I think, wrote this beautiful book called The Spirit Molecule, which talked about his research on giving people, like, you know, a gram of DMT. And gave it to, I think he was at a university in New Mexico, but I read his book some years ago and I can't exactly 100% remember, but it was all the sort of research. He was allowed to do it legally. And of course, DMT, I mean, in certain countries it is considered a drug and it's banned, but it's not actually a drug. It's definitely a supplement. Like, let's say, a B vitamin.
Okay.
And it appears naturally in your body, in your blood. So if DMT is a drug, everybody can get arrested because it's in their blood already.
Better go turn myself in.
Yeah, yeah, so we could all be in trouble. Anyway, it's legal in Portugal, and we do gigs in Portugal, and it's legal in Holland, of course, and we do gigs in Holland. And then, unfortunately, in other areas like England, it was sort of in a gray area, and then the authorities stamped on it and So ayahuasca ceremonies in England have sort of finished. But Portugal, Holland, Ecuador, everything's fine there. You know, and I do know of journeys in America, but it's a bit more esoteric and you have to fish around to find them.
Oh, okay.
So there you go. But that's how I fixed it for people. I taught them how to develop a sensitivity in their feelings. Uh-huh. And then I took them to the ayahuasca, thousands of them. I don't know, maybe 5,000 people came. And some of them went to Darpan in Australia. He's a very famous ayahuasca shaman in Australia, Darpan, D-A-R-P-A-N. And you can click his site and link in with him in that neck of the world, you know?
Sure.
Wow, so that was my system, Ken.
Okay.
That's what I use, simple tricks.
Yeah, and so that, and then your book, you said Sixth Sense. If we don't have access to the DMT immediately, reading that book would help us to follow some pathway to opening up that.
And you know what it is? If you make a little opening in your feelings and you make an act of contrition and you look at your shadow and you become a softer, more humble person, the path and the teachers appear. It's almost like all the evolution is closed down to you if you're harsh and horrid and scared and angry and uptight, and if you're, let's say, out of control, dysfunctional, the doorways are closed. But just a little meditation, a little walking in the park, a little bit of softness, more sensitivity, more kindness. Love your tormentors. That's what I say in my articles. Love your tormentors.
Wow.
And the more you can love your tormentors, the bigger you become, the more your light expands.
Okay. So
because you're not vindictive, you're not angry, you're not uptight, you're not sort of in this sort of righteous indignation. I mean, a lot of people that suffer from righteous indignation are 110% correct. They've got every right to be indignant.
Yeah.
But it doesn't get you anywhere spiritually. It really doesn't.
Ah, okay. So that's good to know. Yes, you have a right to your righteous indignation because stuff has been that wacky on the planet for so long. And if you grab onto that, even though you're right in doing it, it's just going to harm you spiritually, is what I'm hearing you saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying. It's going to harm you spiritually because you can't have vindictiveness and anger. You can only defeat things with softness and love and kindness.
Mm.
So in the end, the harsh world of all of these global fascists and control trippers and all of that world will fall away. And in the end, the meek inherit the earth, and the meek are the people that are aligned to the feminine spirit, that are aligned to the ebb and flow of the Tao, that are aligned to beauty and nature and softness. Organic natural living, let's say, would be a way of describing it.
Ah, okay.
And that involves humility. It involves walking slow. It involves live and let live, you know, allow all the demonic people to be as demonic as they want for as long as they want. It doesn't mean you have to necessarily suffer them because you can always walk away. But you got to, evil has to run its course. It has to be allowed to run its course. It's part of the rules of how this system operates. And then once evil's run its course, then it's destroyed. Because all evil meets a superior force up ahead. And I was shown this in a series of very long visions, maybe 10 or 12 years ago. There's a code inside evil that allows for its self-destruction. But it has to be allowed to get to the point where the code clicks in. So every evil meets a superior evil up ahead, a bigger evil. So, you know, Hitler met the Allies, so to speak. You know, Pol Pot fell. They all fall in the end, but they have to have their time. And so we're in the time of the rise of Hitler. This is the sort of rebirth of Hitler that we're in right now.
Hmm. Now, I don't know if you've come across, there's a movie called Thrive by Foster and Kimberly Gamble that describes, part of the movie describes energy tools that people can use to produce some free energy, just some of the beauty of the torus shape and the crop circles, just some beautiful things.
Oh, yes.
And then he goes into... answering the question, well, why is stuff such a mess? And then it's like, well, if you follow the money, and then he outlines in some detail.
Did you say the film was called Thrive, T-H-R-I-V-E?
Yeah, yeah.
Thrive, yeah, I've not heard of it. Is it like one of those movies that's on, like, YouTube on the internet, not in sort of, can you get it on DVD at the shop? Or?
You can do that if you go to the website thrivemovement.com. You can view it online for a few dollars, and... because I think he describes some important things that would help us to connect to the wisdom of what you're sharing, because his goal in bringing the world back into balance and getting past the dictator and the global fascism is a nonviolent approach like Gandhi or Martin Luther King.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it sounds like that's what you're encouraging us to do also.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, Gandhi was an extraordinary spirit. And I've seen him in those mirror worlds. You know, there's a mirror world opposite us, Ken. And that is like what, let's say, the New Ages would call the spirit world. But it's a mass of dimensions and beings and denizens. I mean, they're not just humans. There's every imaginable type of being in there, demonic beings, celestial beings. But that mirror world is right in front of us. It's really close. If you extend your left arm out, between your elbow and your wrist is where that mirror world starts.
Wow.
So the other dimension or the other world is about 18 inches off the end of your nose.
Hmm.
And all of this information is in there. And everybody has a double in that mirror world, a doppelganger. So they are in the hell worlds already before they're dead. Or they're in the heaven worlds, or they're in the kind of limbo lands in between. And there's mirror world double is already in those worlds. So when you die, your brain has no way of remembering you once you're dead, because there's no electricity to make the synapses happen. And how you remember yourself after you're dead, how you are eternal, is because this mirror double stores all the information of your life.
Wow.
Interesting, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, that is.
So people don't die. I mean, they don't realize that. But people don't die and go to heaven. They die and their mirror self is already in heaven.
Mm.
So
wow.
There's no journey to heaven. You're actually there. There may be a sensation of traveling down a tube and that sort of stuff as the person dies. But they're essentially not traveling anywhere. They're just traveling from their physical body to their mirror world self, wherever that self may be. So all of our destiny is inside this other world. And the other world is really, really close.
Wow! That's pretty exciting to know.
It's not in the Bible, but that's not to make the Bible wrong. It's just they had the technology they had when they wrote the Bible, and this is the modern technology that we've written out since.
Yeah, yeah. Now, as you're you're mentioning some things about being more kind and gentle and compassionate with. Even those that we have a right to detest, and then I'm wondering in the book that I was reading of yours about God's Gladiator, there was mention made that we can't get out of, you said, the field until you drop your need to control. And can you explain a little bit about that?
Well, control is a manifestation of the demonic, because it's a manifestation of possession over another person, to control their feelings or their sexuality or to control their money or to control them with fear and so on. I make a point in my book to differentiate between control and administration. An example I give is that if you had to run a railway, you would have to print schedules and hire drivers for your trains and post it all up on a notice board and tell people what trains to drive at what time when. That's administration. The drivers can come and work on the railway, or they can go get a job on another railway or some completely different job.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not controlling them. It's just administration. But control is when you manipulate people sexually or with anger, or you manipulate them financially, or you use like scare tactics to make them do what you want them to do. And that is like completely demonic, because that's a form of demonic possession. And so you have to give up on trying to control the world and just control yourself as much as you physically can.
Mm. Wow. Okay, well, you've certainly given some incentive there to do that so that we can enjoy the time we're here, because we're not running around.
Yeah, because, you know, if you're trying to control people, it's a nightmare. It's a nightmare for the people you're trying to control, but it's also a nightmare for you.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to get them to do this and to do that and live like this and be like that and acquiesce to this and agree to that. And when they don't, it drives you nuts. You get angry.
Yeah.
And the more you try to control them, the more they try to flee.
Boy,
so,
talk about parents out there. Are you listening? How many parents try to do this?
Well, you know, love is allowing people letting him go. And the whole trick to children, really, is allow him to be. Okay, yeah. You give them various insights and understandings about having how to be safe and so on, but in the end, when they go out the door, you can't control them anyway. So you don't know what they're doing and where they're going. So you're stuffed. All you can do is really control them with your love.
Yeah.
And by showing them a good example. So that's really the answer. It's just, you know, you have to get the children to cooperate, and then they're gonna be bad. They're going to do naughty things, but they have to because they're kids. They need to find out what works and what doesn't.
Yeah. There you go. So you just kind of equip them the best you can, and then let them go.
Yeah, and I think always reasonableness works really well, you know. I had all these kids. I had this huge house in Australia, and all the kids were running around the house, and there's maybe always there 10 or 12 boys were running around, you know. And every morning I'd get up about 7 o'clock in the morning, and the effort to get them all dressed and to get them to have their breakfast, and did they want to go to school, and didn't they want to go to school. So one day I lined them up in the kitchen, and I said to these boys, my son and these other sort of dozen or so boys that were always knocking around the house, I said, listen, kids, it's fine by me if you don't go to school. I absolutely refuse to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning and get you guys ready and cook your breakfast. If you want breakfast, cook your own bloody breakfast. And if you want to go to school, go to school. And if you don't want to go to school and you want to just hang around here and swim and play all day, please do that as well instead. And sure enough, for the first 3 or 4 days, not one of those kids went to school. They just didn't go. But, well, lo and behold, at the end of the week, I saw one coming up the stairs, and he had his little school tote bag on, and I said to him, I said, where are you going, bro? He says, oh, I want to go to school. There's a test today. I want to be sure I take this test. And bit by bit, the children all started going to school. It took about maybe a week to 10 days before they all went. And then after that, I never had a struggle in trying to hustle these kids to go to school every morning. They just went automatically because I wasn't pushing them.
Wow.
Yeah, it was cool. It was cool. Because I before that, my life was a nightmare.
Yeah.
You know, and I might have been up like the 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning writing. And having to get up 5 hours later and trying to get half a dozen or a dozen boys out of bed and washed and clean your bloody teeth and eat this stupid egg. And, you know, it was just a nightmare trying to get them to go to school. So I told them they didn't have to. And after that, I won because they actually went because they wanted to go.
Oh, what a difference. As you were saying that, in my mind, I was getting an image of the old way that you were using. To me, was like salmon swimming upstream to spawn. It's darn hard, and when you're done, you're dead.
It was always an exhaustion. I mean, I was always sort of like completely worn out by 8:15 when the bloody bus came. Yeah. And loaded all these kids onto the bus, you know. And then it was so much easier when I told them they didn't have to go. So I didn't bother about it. They hung around. But it's really weird how, like, a week later, they started going. It was amazing. They went voluntarily.
Wow. So that that letting go of that control.
And it wasn't also, you know, Ken, it wasn't like a week later they went for a few days and then they came back to the house. No, they went, and they went permanently every day till the end of term. They just got up every morning. They cooked their own breakfast. And they fixed themselves up, they looked after each other, they got on the bus and came back at 4:30 or whatever time it was the bus got back.
Wow.
Cool,
wow.
Eh?
Yes.
So absolutely. I think when you let people go, you feel more calm, you're safer, and you're not driving yourself nuts.
Wow. And I'm guessing you're mentioning this example in terms of interacting with these kids, and I'm just wondering if that would extrapolate in terms of our dealing with family or friends or coworkers or
It's my experience that it does. If you allow people to be, okay, coworkers, if they don't want to come to work, obviously you have to lay down boundaries if you're the employer, and you tell people, hey, if you don't want to do the job and you don't want to come to work, fine, just let me know, and I'll hire somebody who does want to come to work. Easy. You know, the family members is the same. If they all want to go nuts, you just allow them to go nuts. It's live and let live. You have to allow people to go towards their own destruction. You have to allow people to make mistakes. And the only thing you don't have to allow is for them to abuse you. So if people are abusing you, then you can say very softly, very quietly, without being angry, I do not accept you abusing me. If you want to abuse people, please find somebody else to abuse. But don't abuse me. It's not appropriate behavior, and I don't accept it. And then once you're definite with your boundaries of what you'll accept and what you won't accept, then if they really are abusive, you have to ask them to leave, or you leave, one of the two.
Yeah, well, that helps clarify things a lot. Instead of
staying
around in a tug of war.
You know, the greatest gift that God gave us is our 2 feet. because it allows us to walk out of any situation that isn't any good. You know, if something's really bad and they won't change, hey, you don't have to sit there and get beaten up. Leave.
Yeah, so you can vote with your feet.
Vote with your feet.
Yeah, I like
and
that.
And there are certain things you can't change. You know, some demonic person or a drug abuser, alcohol abuser that's beaten up his wife and stuff. You can't change them. You can't mamsy-pamsy them around. They're not going to change. They have this evil inside of them, and it's going to stay there probably. So
what do you do then?
You leave.
Okay.
Yep, you got to go. I mean, whether or not that would be rather traumatizing, say, economically, because if you're relying on this tyrant. But in the end, can you live your life as a slave? You have to ask yourself every morning of your life, do I want to be a slave and be terrorized and be manipulated and ripped off, or do I want to be free? And, of course, the answer is you should try to go to be free.
Because
there'll always be somebody somewhere that will love you. You know, if you're a decent person, you'll find love, you'll find kindness, you'll find friendship, you'll find community. You'll find it. So people don't have to be isolated and victimized.
Yeah.
But they do have to have the courage to walk away, and sometimes, of course, they don't, which is natural as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if you've heard of Paramahansa Yogananda and the
yes,
Self-Realization Fellowship. In his book, Metaphysical Meditations, one of his poems talks about, he says, wherever my efforts to do good works are appreciated, that is where I can be of greatest service. And of course, you're kind of saying something to me similar. If you're trying to do good and it's not being appreciated and the people are being nasty, get out of there, because that's not where you can serve. It's not where your life works.
Yeah, and there's a story that I read years ago of a Taoist sage, and his light was so strong and so powerful that he could change the evolution of a village by walking through it. He didn't have to argue or discuss. Often he would just go and sit at the well and maybe chat to people as they came to fill their water buckets. You can fix the world with your light. You don't have to argue with them. And you don't have to confront the demonic or confront tyranny. Because there's no reason to. The light will fry the tyranny anyway.
Mm.
So a lot of people can just feel safe in knowing that they're making a difference, but they're not necessarily making a difference in a logical 3D sense. Because a lot of the time, you're just urinating into the wind, aren't you? You know, it's like you're trying hard and people don't listen because they've got their own ego trips and control trips and they've got their own dysfunction. So you offer them grace. You offer them softness. You offer them the light without them knowing that they're getting the light. You're walking down the street and you're changing the evolution of the world by touching a lamppost, open a cab door, walk into a restaurant. You're making the light go around because you're expressing the light. You just have to have a purity, a softness, and a humility, and the light goes out from you.
Hmm. Wow. Wow. That sounds fabulous. And I'm wondering, in some of this, because with all the craziness going on and the global fascism and the control and the domination and the stuff projected to get even worse, and then you're saying, okay, well, we can't. The best approach isn't to kind of like stand up and build your own army and go after them. It's to love. And then I'm just wondering, would that be considered some form of protection to raise your vibration and remove yourself as much as possible from the stuff? Or what do you do?
Absolutely. You know, I have an internet site, stuartwild.com, and I talk about retreat. You know, this is the year of retreat. This is the year when you've got to pull back out of these systems and allow the fascists to have their time. So it's going to be whatever it's going to be. You can get uptight and you can rant and rave and all of that stuff, but it isn't going to help you. You've got to just pull back and get inside what you know, what you can control easily for yourself without controlling others. And you have to begin to leave. You kind of leave the evolution of the world. And you go into a more silent, more introspective, more carefree world that doesn't involve all the things that are out there. So as people push to make it, and they push to make it financially, and they push to try to become secure, they're actually becoming more insecure, aren't they? Because
yeah.
The effort of pushing burns them out.
Mm.
So that creates paranoia for them. And then they feel tired and depressed, and they hit the bottle, or they're smoking weed, or they're hitting other stuff. And it's a spiral of trying to keep all the ego trips up, balancing all these balls in the air. And the answer to all of that is let them drop. Just walk away, let all the tennis balls hit the ground, and leave. Because in the end, that's where you want to be. You want to be inside a softness, a serenity, in a community of people that have a lot of love, that have an organic way of operating through life.
Wow. Wow. And that's what great advice, because we see all the images that are portrayed through the consumer media of how you got to live to make it in the world, and what you're telling us is that's not the path.
That's not the path. You don't have to make it in the world. You know, the way that you can assist yourself the most is to walk away from it, is to allow it to be and find some simple way of living that doesn't involve a great amount of money and try to be involved as little as possible, because you're never going to be able to fix it. And I wrote in my books that the global ego, the global shadow, has to come out in order for it to be destroyed. And so what we're seeing now with these fascist legislations and the wars and all of these various insanities that are around us is essentially a manifestation of the global ego and its self-importance, its desire for itself. But once you do not have a desire for your own importance, you're free. How you become important is to be not important at all. And so I say in my books, agree to be last and agree to be wrong. So when you argue with people, you say, yep, I'm wrong. And if there's a rush for who's going to get the best seat, allow everybody to go first. Take the worst seat. If there's a rush for the dinner table, allow them all to eat, and you eat at the end if there's some left, if not fast. So I say to people, agree to be last and agree to be wrong. You don't have to be right. You don't have to convince anybody. You don't have to sell them on any idea, particularly. They may accept your ideas, they may not, but there's no point in getting angry or arguing with people. And agree to be wrong, agree to be last, and walk away.
Wow.
So that sets you free. Isn't it true that, you know, if you love a person, you've got to be able to set them free? Then if they come back, it means they love you. Yeah. And if they head off with a FedEx man, well, you're stuffed. You've got to find somebody else. That's the answer, you know. So, I mean, hey, you weren't going to keep them anyway, you know. Sooner or later, they were going to find somebody.
Yeah, some other delivery service was going to come. Who knows?
Yeah, so they got the UPS man instead. So it's like love is letting people go, letting them be free, and supporting them to become whatever they want to become.
Yeah.
And then if they insist on destroying themselves, that's their evolution. That's their karma. You can't fix it anyway. You can't argue. You can't fix them with words. You can't fix a mind with a mind. You can only fix people by example.
Huh.
Gee. And then they may wake up and have this realization of, wow, I'm killing myself doing this stuff, you know. Why don't I go a different way? And that's the world today. The world today is deteriorating at a rapid speed.
Yeah, wow, that's for sure. And what I'm hearing...
It really is. It's deteriorated.
Is, if I'm understanding correctly, what you're saying is if we want to have great love in our lives, it's not about what can I do to make sure someone stays. It's what can I do to make sure that I so love myself and feel so good to be around that they'd never want to leave.
Exactly. They'll come and they'll stay, but they'll always prove to be inadequate until they begin to develop the light themselves.
Ah.
So you have to suffer their inadequacy, and that's nothing grand. It's just observing that they're inadequate. So they're not on time, and they don't contribute, and they rip you off financially, and they're pretty dysfunctional, and they're taking too much of this and too much of that. And there's a dysfunction. But in the end, you have to love their dysfunctions. And at the end, when it gets too heavy, then you have to leave. You have to leave, or you ask them to leave and say, look, I've helped you for 3 months, 6 months, 5 years, 20 years. Now it's time for you to help yourself or go to some other system.
Yeah.
But we're not here... We're not here to rescue people. That's really weird, but we're not. We're not even here to rescue them spiritually, religiously, financially, sexually, emotionally. We're not our brother's keepers. That's not to say we don't have an immense compassion for them and for the animals and for nature. We do. But inside that compassion, we have got to allow them to be whatever they want to be.
You can't beat
them up trying to fix them.
Yeah, and then you're talking about, I think in some of your works, raising your vibration. Like you mentioned, the monk that walks through the village that is exuding so much love that when he's there, the vibration shifts for those around him, and then they become a better village.
Yeah, they get healthier. They heal by the fact that monks walk past them.
And he wasn't in there with a list of things.
You have to have a purity, but it's not a sort of finger-wagging, righteous purity. It's just you have to have a clean living, and you have to have no rancor in your heart. And I write a lot in my books. I wrote a book called The Art of Redemption, and that talks a lot about this journey into one's human shadow to see your disdain and your darkness and your tricks and all that stuff. And so therefore, you've just got to go into that shadow, and you've got to go into understanding where you've gone wrong, and then you've got to blow light and love into that and forgive yourself and move on and become better, a better person, a quieter, softer, kinder, more humble person.
Wow, I love it. That's exciting. Now, over the years, what I'm understanding is that you've made a number of predictions that people, I guess, can track them on your website about world events, and I don't know if you'd mention one or two that are favorites that have come true, and some that you might predictions you might make for the year coming up for us.
Yeah, well, you know, the ones that came true last year was I saw a vision of the death of Gaddafi, and I saw the fall of Mubarak in Egypt and Berlusconi in Italy. And they all came true, and I've seen the end of bullfighting, and bullfighting's dying a death in Spain. Not just because of the amount of matadors that are being hit, but because of the economy. Mm. And so various predictions have come true. I've seen the San Francisco earthquake, like, very intensely. But I cannot tell you when it's going to be. I've got no idea. It could be today. It could be in 4 years' time. But that earthquake is definitely there in those lunar mirror worlds. And a lot of our reality is in this other world before it arrives here. So it's formulated and created in another world, and eventually when it gets to a certain critical mass, it appears here. So I've written these predictions down, and I write them, and people watch them, and then sometimes they come true, and sometimes some of them are still waiting to come true. So it's a time thing. We don't really know how the time construct works between these other mirror worlds and our world.
Hmm. Yeah.
It's too complicated, bro, you know?
Yeah. Well, I know if someone would know, you've studied this for many years of your life.
Yes.
And so when
you say
almost
30 years now.
Yeah.
Like, for example, a few days ago, like maybe a week ago, I saw some trouble in Sicily, and I couldn't quite tell what it was, but I got this feeling that Mount Etna was going to blow. It's a volcano there near Catania. Hmm. Sure enough, 2 days later, it blew. I mean, absolutely boom into the air. And whether or not it's going to continue exploding for the next few weeks or whether it's just a sort of a 1 or 2 or 3 day phenomenon, I don't know. But that explosion of that volcano pre-existed in the mirror worlds before it actually happened on Earth. So that's approximately how the visions work. You're essentially looking at a sort of backwards in time situation. Mm. You're looking in a world where a lot of events have already happened, which haven't arrived in this world yet. And that's how the visions work, talking about what you've seen. But where I fall down dramatically most times, well, not most times, but some of the time, is being able to exactly pinpoint when something will happen.
Mm, the exact time of it.
Yeah, okay. The exact timing is really difficult to get. And then other times, it's not that difficult to get at all.
Ah, okay.
So, like there was a famous politician that got assassinated. And I saw her die 3 days before she actually died. So when I looked in the mirror world, it was close. But when I looked at it, I couldn't have known she was going to die in 72 hours. I just saw her die. And then she was assassinated 3 days later. So we don't know. Sometimes the mirror world stuff is very, very close and immediate. And other times it can linger along for years and years. And, you know, like this San Francisco earthquake thing has been lingering for like at least 5 years, maybe more.
Mm.
So we just have to wait and see. In many ways, I'm happy to be wrong on that one because it would cause devastation, so much loss of life.
Yeah.
So, you know, the longer it takes to arise, the better, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I just wonder if we can, through love and caring and in consciousness, actually postpone some of these events.
Yes, I don't actually know how that system works. But in a place, let's say, like San Fran, which is kind of pretty decadent, you'd be kind of up against with your love and light. You'd be just a flicker of light and a hurricane of decadence. So I'm not 100% sure how you postpone it. But
okay.
It's just a technicality. There's so much of this stuff is so far beyond us that we have no way of mathematically working it out or even really knowing the truth of it all. It's not that easy to work out, you know.
Sure. Now, I know there was some things that I think you'd make mention on your website about, like, oil, different, commodities. And one that came to my attention recently was with Iraq and withdrawing the troops, American troops. Apparently, their currency, the dinar in Iraq, had been devalued massively when the war started, and there's talk about it being revalued and people that own the dinar being able to make many, many huge profits on it.
And yes.
I don't know if you have any thoughts or visions about that.
Well, I'm afraid I don't follow the Iraqi dinar because I'm not really familiar with it. But I've seen this vision of a ship getting hit by a rocket, an oil tanker.
Yeah.
And I've seen it a lot, and especially recently. And so I have been on my site talking to people about buying oil, ETFs, and, you know, being in a position to profit in the event of an oil crisis. And since I wrote all that stuff about 6 months ago, the crisis has developed rather nicely. I mean, the Iranians are threatening to close the Straits of Hormuz, through which a lot of the world oil travels every day. And so you could see this thing happening. You know, you could see this oil crisis happening. It only takes one nutcase to fire one rocket, whether it's the Israelis or the Americans or the Iranians or some even third party, I don't know, like a Somali pirate or something. But it doesn't take much to get this whole thing going. And so I've been telling people, buy gold, even though it may fall from here. It's around 1610, close Friday. Buy gold coins long term for your safety and invest in oil. And then I tell people to invest in sardines because I think there's going to be a food shortage. Mm. So I tell people store some food and get money, cash money out of the bank.
Yeah.
And I suggest to people that they get 26 weeks worth of money out of the bank in cash if they can, of course. So if you're in the habit of, say, taking out $200 a week for groceries and gas and stuff, then you'd have to take $5,200 out in cash out of your bank and stick it under the bed in the event that the cash machines break down. And that could easily happen because a lot of the banks are in a very, very difficult situation and they're very, very highly leveraged and they've had to borrow hundreds of billions, even trillions from the Federal Reserve in order to stay up. And so the whole system is kind of teeter-tottering upon a collapse. And so you could see the ATM machines, the cash machines closing down and problems with food distributions and oil price rises and so on. And then the Iraqi dinar, I suppose it would only climb if there was a perception of stability there. But they've had these incredible amounts of bombings in Baghdad recently. So I don't know whether a perception of stability is how you would describe the Iraqi situation at the moment.
Right, so they've got a ways to go before it's somewhat stable.
Yeah, and they could easily get carried away with this whole uprising in Syria and the argument between Israel and Iran, and the Americans have got their battle fleet down there, and the British are thinking of sending their battle fleet if they can find one, and they're thinking of sending them down there, and so the whole thing down there is really hot enough for a big mess.
Yeah.
So I think going long on the Iraqi dinar would be probably a pretty scary tactic. I'd rather go long on oil.
Okay.
And go short the euro. I predicted the euro would collapse, and it's come down a lot. I mean, it's come down from when I first predicted it. I think it was 142 to the dollar, and it's now collapsed down to 128 to the dollar. And I think it's going to go all the way down to par. You know, €1, $1.
Mm.
So you can bet on euro short, oil long, buy sardines, stick them in the garage, and put some cash under the mattress. Those are the four tactics. Oh, and gold.
Yeah.
Those are the tactics that I advise my readers. Sensible things, huh?
Yeah, they are. And I'm wondering, because I think you make mention of the major religions on the planet have been part of the control mechanism for many years, and I'm just curious, where does a person turn to find some actual decent spiritual support?
Well, you know, there are beautiful things in the Buddhist texts and in the Bible and so on, and I'm sure there's some beautiful writings in the Quran. I have read the Quran, but I don't remember it because it was a long time ago. But all of that beauty in the religions is there for us to use and understand. But in the end, where do you turn? Well, you turn within. And you come to a simplicity, and sometimes you don't really need any answers at all. All you need is to do whatever's right in front of you. So you sweep in the kitchen floor, that can become a prayer, so that you sweep it in such a zen-like, beautiful way that it's like an offering to the gods. Hey, here's this beautiful floor. So in the end, where do you turn for answers? Well, the best thing is not to turn for answers, but to go within and feel out what your strongest, most celestial strategy is. And that's your answer. And sometimes it's move, and sometimes it's simplify, and sometimes it's please make peace with the people you fought with, and sometimes it's please stop telling lies and being dysfunctional, and sometimes it's walk in these trees, they're beautiful, and see their beauty and their warmth. It's different answers to different people, but it's going within is the answer. It has to be. Because that's where your truth is, you know, where your feelings guide you to your real truth, stuff that's not of the ego, that's not of insanity, that's not of dysfunction.
Right.
So we turn within and learn to trust that.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things is you're talking about some things of preparedness, and I recently had some time to interact with some folks from the Mormon Church, and
yes,
that was kind of unique in discovering that since they began, they've talked about be prepared, have food, take care of each other, and they're well organized as a group to help look after each other's needs.
Yep.
And I don't know if you have any thoughts or have had any interactions.
No, I think their philosophy is absolutely accurate. And when I lived in New Mexico and I did these Warriors Wisdom seminars, I had a group of Mormons that would come down and run the ropes courses, and I found them such spiritually sort of pure people. You know, they weren't rip-off artists, and they showed up and did a lovely job, and they did it on time, and it was a joy and delight to do business with them. So there's a lot about that Mormon religion that allows for sort of a proper living, and yeah, they tell you store this amount of food and, you know, prepare for... I mean, the advice would have come from the 1800s.
Yeah.
When they could have had, you know, famine and floods and pestilence. But in this day and age, it makes sense as well, because there could easily be a disruption in food supplies, medical supplies, and so forth. So if you take tablets or something like that, it'd be good to go get several sort of back-to-back prescriptions and cash them in at the drugstore if you can, and have your tablets, you know, a 6-month supply or 1-year supply of your tablets. And that's just all sensible stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I wrote a very impacting article, The Day the Fat Go Hungry. And it was essentially like, what's going to happen when this sort of McNuggets truck doesn't arrive? And it's going to happen. It's going to happen because these wars are sort of simmering. And all of these ego trips and all this push and shove over there in the Middle East, sooner or later, it's going to flare up. You kind of know it is. So, yeah, you know, I don't know what the Mormon teaching is, but I think they say that you're supposed to have a year's worth of food, and that sounds jolly sensible. I'd certainly say have 6 months' worth.
Yeah.
And, hey, you can get 20 kilos of rice, and it'll last for God knows how many months.
Right.
And cans and that kind of stuff. Simple stuff that you can make sure that you have a certain amount of nutrition for yourself and your family in the event that the McNuggets don't show up.
Yeah. It makes beautiful sense.
Makes sense.
Lord, I wish we could keep talking for another hour, because I feel like we're just getting started and we've blazed through our time.
Well, another day, eh? It's been beautiful. Thank you so much for having me on, and I'm always honored that people would want to listen to what I have to say.
Oh, this is a thrill for me and my listeners, and I will be excited to hopefully I'd like to interact with you in terms of maybe check out that movie Thrive. And
yes. I jotted it down while you were talking, and I've got it in my Google search. I just haven't clicked it so I wouldn't distract myself while the radio show was on.
Okay. Well, fantastic. And just so appreciate it. And folks, go to Stuart, S-T-U-A-R-T, Wild, W-I-L-D-E.com for so much more detail than we've been able to cover. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. And until we meet again, Stuart, my beloved listeners, God bless, and goodbye for now.
Let go.